5. New arrivals. While the faith is engaged in its main modern battle with the positive forces of nationalism and anti-clericalism, the negative force of intellectual decline, those who are to be our next antagonists, after these are spent, wait in reserve, they will conduct the attack in the near future. To change the metaphor, the new arrivals are waiting in the wings while the main opposition of our day still fills the stage and the survivals are filing away to their exits. Now, to appreciate the character of the new arrivals at any epoch of the Church Saint history is essential to understanding her position at that epoch, but it is also the hardest task of all. It is essential, because, by the nature of the new arrivals, do we test the effect the Church is having on her time, the reaction which she, for the moment, provokes. It is difficult because the things to be studied are not yet developed. They are still slight in substance or embryonic in form. The survivals we know thoroughly. They are our acquaintances from childhood, our senior friends. Everyone recognizes them and knows all about them. They were familiars of our own parents and we half regret their passing. But the new arrivals are oddities, disturbing or ignored. Many of us have hardly come across more than one of them. Such as we have met come little into our lives, and when they do, so irritate us with their crudity or incomprehensibility that it is easier to turn aside from them and forget them. The dear old higher critic, the cousinly agnostic with his test tubes and little geological hammer, these are of the household as it were, furniture as domestic to us as the landscape of home. And Harnack still with us, Renan and Huxley lately gone, the decorous melancholy of Arnold, are on the best used shelf of our library. But when it comes to the men who chat pleasantly with the dead, to the men who like discords and music, to the men who prefer the ugly in paint and stone, to the men who openly despair, to the men who willingly share their wives, to the men who laud what we used to call perversion in sex, to the men who find honor quaint and to the men who respect theft and swindling, we not only feel out of place but superior and impatient, as though these barbaric futilities were so ephemeral as hardly to be taken seriously. But we should beware of that mood or it may make us underestimate our enemies. When I say we, I speak of my own generation, and I that am writing here am close on 60. It may be that men and women in the 30s would write differently and feel for the new arrivals more respect. Well, when we do look long enough at the new arrivals pressing to come forward, we discover one very interesting mark common to them all. They are at issue with the Catholic Church not directly on doctrine as were their elders, but on morals. Morals derive from doctrine, of course, and indirectly the quarrel is doctrinal, as all human conflicts are. But the distinctive note of the new arrivals is that they do not propose new theses to be held in theology, as did the heresiarchs of old, nor first principles in philosophy which contradict the first principles of the faith, as did our 19th century opponents, but that they have a new ethic or perhaps none. All the survivals and even the agents of the present main opposition maintained and maintain in practice and more or less even in theory the bulk of Catholic morals. They inherited these from the past. They were and are part of that general European civilization which was the creation of the Catholic Church. But the new arrivals are, in greater and lesser degree, shedding so much of this heritage that they are of a novel kind. They speak in a new language. Herein lie both the peril and the acute interest of our moment. We are approaching unknown forms in the conflict between the Church and the world. We are about to meet, or our children are not, the assault of rebels, men of our own speech and manner, but the assault of aliens. Hitherto it has been civil war, it is soon to be invasion. Hitherto the mysteries have been abandoned as unreasonable or illusory. For instance, the Eucharist, the Incarnation. The strict discipline of the faith has been rejected as too harsh or too meticulous. Theology has been ridiculed as a map of terra incognita, a whimsical imagination. The official framework of the Church has been attacked as tyrannical and man-made, lacking true authority. The main doctrines even of the Godhead as lacking evidence and therefore negligible. Hitherto all manner of competing systems in thought have been proposed for the supplanting of the faith. But throughout these age-long quarrels the tradition of Catholic culture has been preserved. Those in theory most opposed to the faith have in practice followed the conventions of Europe. Even when they attacked property or marriage it was in the name of justice. They maintained the concept of human dignity. They were indignant, in all their vagaries, against evils such as oppression of the poor, which the faith itself had taught men to hate. Now something quite other is beginning to show, a strange new paganism. We are concerned to discover its quality, what older allies it will find, and whether it may not be the forerunner of some new positive religion. What quality has it, this new paganism? To what allies older than itself may it rally? Does it portend the advent of a new positive religion to be set up against the Church in the last days? Those three questions I would now examine. Neopaganism. It is the common and very true remark of those who survey the modern world as a whole, and especially of those who survey it from the central standpoint, which is that of the Church, and more particularly of those who survey it from the heart of contemporary discussion, which is in France, that the struggle now lies between the Catholic Church and paganism. That is now a truism to all save the provincial and belated. But what paganism? Therein lies our interest. Certainly it is not the paganism of that radiant Greco-Latin antiquity from which we sprang. The pristine things are not recovered through decay. Senility may be called second childhood, but we do not find in it the eagerness and vitality of youth. Popular faith having rotted into that base welter called the modern mind, there has arisen a growth from the slime. That growth is certainly a paganism. But a paganism of what character, of what smell, taste and stuff? We must know that if we are to guess at its results. First, why do we call it a paganism at all? Paganism at large may be defined as natural religion acting upon man uncorrected by revelation. If the word uncorrected seems unsuitable, for after all, natural religion is true as far as it goes, and the truth does not, qua truth, need correction, let me substitute for the term uncorrected the term unsupplemented. Paganism is what the special language of Saint Paul calls the old Adam, and what we today would put in terms more normal to our idiom as the natural man. Let us see in what this religious attitude, for it is a religious attitude as are indeed all fundamental attitudes of the mind, consists. Man has a conscience. He knows the difference between right and wrong. He also is necessarily aware of certain great problems upon his nature, and destiny, which he may not be able to solve, but the solution of which, if it could be reached, must be far more important for him than anything else. Does he only mature, grow old and die, or is that process but part of a larger destiny? Have his actions permanent or only ephemeral consequences to himself? Are awful unseen powers to which he devotes gratitude, worship and fear, imaginations of his or real? Are his dead no longer in being? Is he responsible to a final judge? He may decide that as there is no evidence, no conclusion is possible, that the search for it is a waste of effort and any apparent discovery thereof an illusion. But he cannot deny that on what the answer is did he but know it, all conduct and all values turn. He has a sense of beauty which is, in the average man, strongly founded, and consonant to the great Catholic doctrine that the creation is good. He is necessarily informed by a sense of justice, and feels that some degree of conformity to it is necessary to the very existence of civil society. He recognizes, does the natural man inspired by natural religion, the folly and danger of excessive pride, of excessive appetite, anger, and the rest, for he has humor to keep him sane. It might seem at first sight that man thus turned loose and sufficient unto himself would fall into a vague but contented philosophy under which we would live well balanced, as the animals live normally to their instincts, and that the pagan would be the least troubled of men. That man would so live if he were left free from the trammels of what calls itself revelation is the fundamental doctrine of all that movement which has been leading us back towards paganism. There is already present among us the conception that paganism, once re-established, will result in a decently happy world, at any rate a world happier than that world of Christendom which was formed throughout the centuries under the spell of the faith. But it is not so. There appears one eccentric point of supreme moment, most revealing, bidding us all pause. It is this: paganism despairs. Man turned loose finds himself in exile. He grows desperate, and his desperation breeds monstrous things. Each kind of paganism came to suffer from horrid gods of its own at last, and these give to each paganism its particular savor. But the mark of the new paganism is that it has not reached these last stages by a long process of debasement. It is not entering a period of fresh life. Its gods are already the vile gods of complexity and weakness. The new paganism is born precocious and diseased. We conceive of the pagan, when first we hear of his advent, as a normal man. We all sympathize with him in our hearts. We all understand him. Many of us have been at one time or another, mostly in youth, of his company. What quarrel, we then asked, has revealed religion with him? Wherein lies his weakness? We know now. It lies in his rejection of a central spiritual truth, to wit, that man is permanently degraded in his own eyes without escape, that he has in him the memory of things lost, that he is of heavenly stuff, condemned and broken. It is the doctrine which we Catholics call the fall of man. We cannot use that doctrine as an argument against the pagan, because if we do so, we are, in the eyes of the pagan, begging the question. But what will appeal to him and to any observer from without, is this, that paganism, the natural man, acting without revelation, does not conform to his own nature. He is not in equilibrium and repose. It looks as though he ought to be, but in fact he is not. Before the advent of the faith, even despair could struggle to be noble. But since the medicine for despair has been known, those who refuse the remedy turn base. Europe, expecting it knew not what, was one thing. Europe baptized and apostatizing is quite another. Its material has changed. The new pagan, of course, laughs at the strict doctrine of the fall, but he cannot laugh at the actual fact that man, when he acts as though he were sufficient to himself, not only permanently, necessarily and regularly does a myriad things of which he is himself ashamed, not only lacks the power to establish his imaginary healthy normal condition, but increasingly, as his pagan society progresses, falls into worse and worse evils. That is patently true. It is not a theory of what should happen when men cease to accept the truth upon man's saint nature. It is a statement of what does actually happen, witnessed to by all contemporary history and by the experience of individual characters. The old pre-Catholic paganism did evil but admitted it to be evil. One of the greatest, and, I think, the most tragic lines in Latin verse is that famous phrase, Video meliora, prebuc, deteriora sequer. It is a very epitome of the human story, of one man and of all. But the new paganism works in an attempted denial of good and evil which degrades all it touches. Well, then, we say pagan society ends in despair. But despair is not normal to men. Despair is not the healthy mental state of the healthy natural creature. To say that it is so would be a contradiction in terms. Therefore do we find the old paganism of the classics accompanied by a perpetual attempt to cheat despair by the opiates of beauty or of stoic courage. But the new paganism lives in despair as an atmosphere to be breathed, lives on it as a food by which to be nourished. The new paganism then, which is just raising its head, has this quality distinguishing it from the old, that it is beginning where the old left off. If all paganisms end in despair, ours is accepting it as a foundation. That is the special mark we have been seeking to distinguish this new arrival. Hence the lack of reason, which is intellectual despair, the hideous architecture and painting and writing, which are aesthetic despair, the dissolution of morals, which is ethical despair. The thing is as yet unformed and only shocking in isolated instances. It is tentative as yet, not universal, rather appearing so far, as a series of special lapses from the old Christian standards of civilization in this, that and the other respect, than as a mode. Some few deliberately detestable buildings and sculptures in our towns, especially in our capitals. Books, still somewhat eccentric, portraying every vice, the forced and still novel apology and speech for evil of every kind, preferably for the worst. All these are still no more than isolated insults and challenges. The new paganism is still no more than a new arrival, but it is rapidly growing. It is also gathering cohesion, and it cannot but appear in full and formidable strength within a comparatively short period as historical time is reckoned. We elder people may not live to see the thing full blown, though I think we shall, noting as I do the pace at which change is proceeding, but our children will certainly see it. When it is mature, we shall have, not the present isolated, self-conscious insults to beauty and right living, but a positive coordination and organized affirmation of the repulsive and the vile. The new paganism is advancing to its completion. It is about to take on body and to act as one. To appreciate that truth, take the instance of marriage. Antique paganism held the institution of marriage, but of marriage as a civil contract and dissoluble. When the Catholic Church had succeeded to the pagan empire, it declared marriage holy and indissoluble. It affirmed of marriage and the instincts on which marriage was based, not only that they were good, but that the institution itself was a sacrament. The Manichaean, that is, the Puritan, regarded these instincts as evil. The Church restricted them outside the sphere of marriage. The Manichaean condemned them altogether. The neo-pagan objects to both. He would set up man as an animal. He would, so far, make of marriage nothing but a civil contract terminable on the consent of both parties. Soon he must make it terminable at the will of only one. The older heretics in this matter emphasized the human misery caused by the doctrine of indissoluble marriage, denied its divine sanction, and worked to abolish its consequences in law. The new pagans reject it from the root. Logically, the neo-pagan should get rid of the institution of marriage altogether, but the very nature of human society, which is built up of cells each of which is a family, and the very nature of human generation, forbid such an extreme. Children must be brought up and acknowledged and sheltered, and the very nature of human affection, whereby there is the bond of affection between the parent and the child, and the child is not of one parent but of both, will compel the neo-pagan to modify what might be his logical conclusion of free love and to support some simulacrum of the institution of marriage. But his aim is opposed to the whole scheme, and we may truly say that the facility and frequency of divorce is the test of how far any society once Christian has proceeded towards paganism. Neo-paganism grows prodigiously. The process has till recently been masked by the fragmentary survival of the Catholic scheme, in attenuated and rapidly disappearing forms. Throughout the Protestant culture, the tradition of free will, for instance, with its strong effects upon the organization of society, still lingers, retarding the return of servile conditions in industrial England. You may even note with surprise occasional spasmodic rebellions by the individual against monopoly, legal, economic or political, the survival, however vague and attenuated, of some dogma such as that of future reward and punishment for conduct in this life, or of human equality in despite of riches. These remnants of Catholic doctrine both put a brake upon the pace of the great change and hide the process from the eyes of the average observer. But I do not see what chance of survival these fragments have in the modern world outside the Catholic body itself, the full corpus of Catholic faith and discipline in communion with Rome. So long as there were definite Protestant creeds, more or less thought out and sustained by logic of a kind, so long as men could say what they thought and acted thus and thus, paganism was kept out. Whether this were to the advantage or disadvantage of mankind may be debated, just as one may debate whether it is better for a body to be warped or to be dead. But at any rate, so far as our present problem goes, these poor survivals of isolated and in large part distorted Catholic doctrines opposed the return of paganism. Take, for instance, the Catholic doctrine of charity. Out of that sprang, in the Middle Ages, and has been carried on to our own time, the whole body of social services, relief of the poor, hospitals, and the rest. These continue after a fashion, though the tradition outside the Catholic body has degenerated into sentimentalism on the one side and wild egalitarian extravagance upon the other. But present is, or for the moment, these distortions of sane Catholic truth. They cannot survive, because they do not answer the question why. Why should one be charitable to owns and fellow men? Why should one be at a burden, social or personal, of tending the sick with particular care and saving suffering, even to the poorest? The old paganism did not do these things. It permitted, for sport, such cruelty to man as Catholicism alone dispelled. Most people, if they were asked to answer this question why, would reply that such charity was part of men's ain't natural instincts. But all pagan history and pagan literature is there to prove the contrary, or at any rate, that if a certain measure of charity be part of natural religion, and thus admitted by pagan man, he does not act upon it. For, when a consistent creed is absent, the various parts of moral action are disassociated one from another, and all rapidly fail. To take another instance, why should I believe in moral sanctions applicable in a future life? So long as people went definitely by an accepted body of doctrine, such as the Calvinist, even so long as they accepted the authority of canonical scripture, though at their own individual interpretation there was cohesion and therefore a principle of survival in the whole of what they thought and did. But when these creeds and authorities have gone and take the white world as a whole, there is not much of them left today outside the Catholic Church. No guide to conduct remains but the instincts of men left to themselves, uncorrected, and the tendency to satisfy those instincts, even to their own hurt. Paganism, once erected into a system, once having taken on full shape, and proceeding to positive action, must necessarily become a formidable and increasingly direct opponent of the Catholic Church. The two cannot live together, for the points upon which they would agree are not the points which either thinks essential. The clash must arise at first indirectly. A pagan state makes certain laws which are repugnant to the Catholic conscience, laws concerning marriage or property, or domestic habits in eating and drinking, or concerning the freedom of labor, or any other function of the dignity of man. It proposes, let us say, what is called the sterilization of the unfit, or compulsion in the matter of hours and wages, compulsory arbitration, the beginning of fully servile institutions or eugenics, or the compulsory limitation of progeny, or any other nastiness. In no such examples, in one might add a hundred more, would it be possible for the Catholic individual or the Catholic body to approve or even to stand aside as a neutral. We have seen how this is so in the case of a universal compulsory educational system. There the Catholic objection is obvious, but it is present also, though less obvious, in any other hypothetical case you may consider. There will arise, as the new paganism spreads, instances in which a Catholic finds himself asked to obey a law which he cannot in conscience obey, as for instance, to make a declaration of mental incapacity in a dependent, well knowing that this will legally involve castration. There cannot be an indefinite postponement of the issue. I have suggested that the threat of paganism returning among the white races, and the strength of paganism when it shall have returned, will be presumably enhanced by a sort of moral alliance between it and the exterior paganism of the East, of Asia, and not only of Asia, but, for that matter, of Africa too. Now such a statement sounds, when it is put thus simply and shortly, and today, too unlikely to be acceptable. Its unlikeliness is even violent in the ears of the modern man. We have stood apart for centuries from organized heathendom, that great sea surrounding the island of Christendom. Latterly, that is, during the last three centuries, but especially during the 19th, we had even grown to despise the heathen world. It was far weaker than ourselves in military power, and in nearly all those arts of life which, even as we lost our own religion, we had come to regard as the most important.